Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 16th, 2005. This session, Ruth, The Grace of God and a Game of Footsie. A Bible study conducted by Hans Dahl in the Fireside Room. Disc number DAH-2005-04. Let's listen in.
Twins, but you've already been in an orphanage, and they have been adopted off with different families.
Well, here we go again. Huh? We're getting towards the end of Ruth, and...
That's the only book in the Bible that I can spell.
I figured it was the only book we could get through the whole thing in 1 week. How about that?
Oh, so Philemon, we should be able
to. Oh, we can do that, yeah. There's a few others.
Just go do like one young pastor we got in our church, one sermon, that was the whole sermon. Was
he just sat and read?
Read Philemon.
Wow.
That's a short one, isn't it?
Wow. That's kind of a deal, you know?
I think he wished he had never done it because every time he reminded him of it.
What were you thinking? Yeah. It was funny, I get this. It's just, you know, you get these little notes from people. A mother called her son on Sunday morning to make sure he got out of bed for church on Sunday morning. I'm not going, he replied, you know, talking to his mom on the phone. Yes, you are going, so get out of bed, the mother said. Demanded. Give me one reason why I should go to church this morning, the son said. I'll give you three good reasons, the mother said. One, I'm your mother, and I say you're going. Two, you're 40 years old, and you should know better. And three, you're the pastor, so you need to be there. There's another one in here. Favorite hymns for different professions. You know, you do know that the hymns in the LBW, you know, the Lutheran Book of Worship, or whatever hymnal you have, were written for specific professions. So you've got like the Zookeeper's Hymn, All Creatures of Our God and King. You've got, let me see, what's the other one here? The Shoe Repairman's Hymn, It Is Well With My Soul. Let's see, the Golfer's Hymn, There Is a Green Hill Far Away, or the Tailor's Hymn, you know, the seamstress, Holy, Holy, Holy. The Contractor, The Church's One Foundation, and my favorite, the Dentist's Hymn, Crown Him with Many Crowns. Anyway, well, let's dig into Ruth here. We're on the fourth chapter of Ruth, so we're kind of going into the home stretch here. We've been kind of putzing through the book of Ruth, and so we're sliding into home plate here. But just as kind of a reminder of, I think it's always good to kind of be grounded, and I've kind of done this each day, is to go back to the first chapter, first few verses, and we're reminded of the situation that Ruth is that's happening here. Ruth is in a foreign land. She's lost her husband. She's lost her son. Or I'm sorry, Naomi is in a foreign land. Lost her husband. Lost her sons, and so she's alone, and she's destitute. And the question for her is, how is she going to find security? Question number one. And the other question is, how is she going to find food? And so we find her going to Moab, where there's food, and then the Lord providing back in Bethlehem. Back in Bethlehem. And so the question is, first, how is she going to find food? And we find out in verse 6 of the first chapter of Ruth, that it's the Lord that provides. The Lord is the Lord considers his people and gives them food. We find that in verse 6 of chapter 1 of Ruth. And now we go to chapter 4, and we still have that question of security. How is Ruth and Naomi, especially Naomi, the kind of the main character in this story, how is Naomi going to find security? And we've had the scene now in the threshing room, on the threshing room floor, and we find that there's hope in this kinsman, Boaz. Boaz, whose name means, in him is strength. some beautiful language used here in the book of Ruth. And so we go on to chapter 4, and I'm wondering, would someone be willing to read verses 1 through 6 of chapter 4?
All right, thank you, Irene. Boaz went to the meeting place at the town gate and sat down there. Then Elimelech's nearest relative, the man whom Boaz had mentioned, came by, and Boaz called to him, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Then Boaz got 10 of the leaders of the town and asked them to sit down there too. When they were seated, he said to his relative, "Now that Naomi has come back from Moab, she wants to sell a field that belonged to our relative Elimelech, and I think you ought to know about it. Now then, if you want it, buy it in the presence of these men sitting here. But if you don't want it, say so, because the right to buy it belongs first to you and then to me." The man said, "I will buy it." Boaz said, "Very well, if you buy the field from Naomi, then you are also buying Ruth, the Moabite widow, so that the field will stay in the dead man's family." The man answered, "In that case, I will give up my right to buy the field, because it would mean that my own children would not inherit it. You buy it. I would rather not."
So we found out that there's this kind of this mystery redeemer, this mystery next of kin, you could say. And we don't know really where this person came from. Our text doesn't really tell us, but there's this other person. And so Boaz, part of the reason for this character coming into being is to show the character of Boaz. Boaz is this person of loyalty. And I would say throughout this story, Boaz is the hand of God at work. We don't want to make Boaz the hero of the story or the main focus of the story, but I would say that Boaz acts as God's hand in this story. And here we have a further development of Boaz's character. Boaz says, "Well, I'm not really your next of kin. There's actually this other person." And we don't understand necessarily if Naomi knew who this other character was. We don't really have many of the details. But the purpose of this other character, this other next of kin, is to help us understand the kind of character Boaz is. He's a person of honesty, and he's going to make sure that things are done right. And in doing that, make sure that not only for himself, but for Naomi and for Ruth, that things are done right in the proper way. And so we have this other character that enters in here. And so just going back to the beginning of chapter 4, just kind of go through it slowly. And please, if you have any questions or thoughts about this at all, please holler out. I hope that we can have some discussion. No sooner had Boaz gone up to the gate and sat down there than the next of kin whom Boaz had spoken to. Now, next of kin, this is kind of a legal term there, this next of kin. It really means redeemer. We read back in Deuteronomy about this idea of marriage and what happens to property and what is the responsibility of relatives when say the father dies and there are no kids. What happens to that property? Well, this is a kind of a unique situation because there are no male relatives left, and so there's this next of kin, this redeemer. This one, if they had gone away and their land was gone, this redeemer is a legal term for someone who has the right to buy back this land so that it might stay within the family. So this next of kin is kind of a legal term. So then the next of kin, whom Boaz had spoken, came passing by. So Boaz said, "Come over here, friend, and sit down here." And he went over and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. It seems like he's gathering a group of people there.
It seems to me they're witnesses.
Yeah.
So that if the guy wants to renege.
Why else would they gather people together? they might. I was reading through this morning, and I thought, you know, Ruth and Naomi came from a place of being totally alone. They were totally alone, especially you think of Ruth being this outsider, this one who was totally rejected. And now you see, I think in this chapter, is really this idea of total redemption for them, this idea of reconciliation that's not just a personal reconciliation, but it's a communal reconciliation. So Boaz, showing his character again, is saying, okay, we're going to bring these people, not only am I going to marry myself to this woman, but we're going to bring her back into the fold of the community so that true restoration can happen. So you've got this opposite of what we find in the very beginning of the story, that she's restored into the life of the community. Okay, so you've got these 10 elders, they're at the gate of the city. He said to the next of kin, the redeemer, the one who has the rights to redeem Naomi. Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our kinsman, Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. Now we don't know, it doesn't necessarily make sense, I think, when I read this, as to how Naomi had the right to sell this property and exactly how that works. Because my understanding is that, for better or for worse, I think for worse, women didn't have the right to own land in this day. And so some have hypothesized that what was going on here is that she had lost the land, and now she was looking for someone to purchase it back, and somehow she had some rights to choose who that person would be, who that person would be who brought redemption to her family. But we don't know exactly what's going on here. We know that the original readers probably would have understood this, but it's confusing to us. But we keep going. Verse 4. So I thought I would tell you about it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, so that I may know. For there is no one prior to you to redeem it, and I come after you. So he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, the day you acquire it, by the way, the field from the land, the field from the hand of Naomi, you are also, by the way, acquiring Ruth, the Moabite. Oh yeah, there's something else that goes along with this land. So you're also acquiring the hand of Ruth, the Moabite. It's interesting, again, we're pointed out here, it's still Ruth, the Moabite. She is the outsider, the widow of the dead man, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance. So the purpose of this whole transaction is to keep Elimelech's name on the land. It's to keep the family name. And so to do that, there would also have to be some kind of a marriage into the family. And this would be with the Moabite woman, Ruth. At this, going on to verse 6, at this the next of kin said, I cannot redeem it for myself without damaging my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it.
Is this the point that if he, there wasn't anybody after him to, like Boaz, then the sandal would come off and...
Yeah, the whole sandal. We're getting to the sandal part. Yeah, I think. Are you talking about from Deuteronomy where we read? Yeah,
that's where we read it.
Yeah. Well.
And then that person who refused is sort of ostracized from the community.
Yeah. And I think the language is a little bit different here. I think we're going to find out that. Well, why do you think he chooses not to redeem this? Why he chooses not to take this deal, because it seems like kind of a sweet deal. Why do you think he chooses not to?
He had a wife.
Could be. What else? Does anyone else have any ideas? Why would he not choose?
Well, it says here he couldn't do it without damaging his own inheritance. So he's thinking about his children.
Yeah, he's thinking about himself. Yeah.
Although he agrees to the land transaction, but not to Ruth.
Yeah.
You know, which I don't know if it has something to do with her, you know, being, you know, him excluding her yet, you know, not quite accepting her because she's a Moabite. I don't know if that's behind it or not.
Yeah, it's interesting because all of a sudden it's, oh yeah, and by the way, this woman comes with it. Oh no, I don't want anything to do with this. No. I don't want anything. Well, and there is this sense that, now let's say that they were married and they had a child. And we know from kind of the laws and whatnot that child would the name of the child would stay within Elimelech's family if it were a male son. And legally, that son would then have the right to the land because it was in his father's name. So in a sense, if this man chose the Moabite woman and then they had a male son, the land would go to the son and would no longer stay with him. So it's almost like it's a moral decision that he'd be making. It would be a saying, okay, I want to do this for the sake of Ruth and Naomi, to redeem them out of loyalty for their family. I'm making this decision. And so it's almost like, and this is what I read into it, it's almost like he understands, it's like all of a sudden he kind of clicks in his head, oh, wait a second, in the long run, I'm going to end up losing this land too. So there is some sense in that. But go ahead.
Well, I've always understood this as Boaz gives the land, mentions the land first, and so the guy says, sure, and then he mentions the woman, because Boaz wants the woman, and he knows that this is going to be a problem for the guys. Uh-huh. At least that's the way I've always understood it.
Yeah. It's interesting, they don't ever name this character.
No.
You never know who he is. You know?
Quite a bit of scripture here
devoted
to this little incident.
Yeah. But there's never a name. And so what is the purpose of these verses? You know, why do they put this in here? And I think it really goes back to Boaz. You know, it's again developing his character, that he's this person who's going to kind of follow the rules even to excess. We read back, I'm trying to remember where it was. Turn back to chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 10. It says, he said, this is Boaz speaking, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. You have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. There is this sense that Ruth is not bound by any legal, there's no legal responsibility for her to necessarily go with the next of kin. She's this Moabite woman, she's from another country, she doesn't fit all the rules that we read about. So she doesn't necessarily have to kind of follow these rules of marrying the next of kin. And so there's this sense that this is all about her loyalty to Naomi. That she's loyal to Naomi even to the point of following insider rules. You know, your land will be my land. Your people will be my people. And so she's following as though she is a legitimate daughter of Naomi. So we go back here in this back to the chapter 4, verse 7. Now this was a custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one took off a sandal and gave it to the other. This was the manner of attesting in Israel. So here's your sandal, Bert.
Yeah. But this is a positive.
Yeah, this is different.
The other one was sort of an accusation. You didn't follow the rules.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to that one more time. Deuteronomy 25, just to look at that. Just to kind of compare. So this is a key part of scripture where we look to find out, okay, what are the rules concerning marriage, and if the father dies, then what happens? And we've read this already this week, but I think it's good because it refers to this whole business of the sandal. Would somebody read this section here from 5 to 10? Would somebody be willing to do that? Anybody? All right, thanks.
When brothers reside together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her, taking her in marriage and performing the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man has no desire to marry his brother's widow, then his brother's widow shall go up to the elders at the gate and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of the town shall summon him and speak to him. If he persists, saying, "I have no desire to marry her," then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and declare, "This is what is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house." Throughout Israel, his family shall be known as the house of him whose sandal was pulled off.
Can't help but chuckle, spit in his face. Huh? Yeah, so this is a situation where there's kind of a negligence or a refusal to support the family. It's like a moral objection here. And we don't really get that sense in Ruth. You know, it's not this kind of moral objection. I think it's more of, you know, as Orpah chose not to go with Naomi back to Bethlehem, so also now this mystery character is choosing not to go along with the deal. So it's not necessarily a refusal, but he's saying, "No, you take this. This is your deal." So the sandal obviously has something to do with the transaction. You know, it's like property, I guess you could say, which is a horrible way to look at marriage. And a woman's rights. So verse 8 here. So when the next kin, or this redeemer, said to Boaz, "Acquire it for yourself," he took off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have acquired from the hand of Naomi all that belongs to Elimelech and all that belongs to Chilion and Mahlon." So it's interesting here that the words are very intentional. In verse 9, then Boaz said to the elders, so this group of witnesses, but not just them, to all the people, again increasing the community that is going to be share in this celebration, that Boaz is bringing these people, Naomi and Ruth, back into the fold. So all the people will be witnesses to this. "Today you are witnesses that I have acquired from the hand of Naomi all that belongs to Elimelech and all that belongs to Chilion and Mahlon, those who should have received this inheritance. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite." Now again, still even now after he's chosen to marry this woman, she's still Ruth, the Moabite. It's as if he's trying to make a statement here. He's saying, I am choosing this one that you would not choose, this woman who's an outsider. I'm choosing Ruth the Moabite, the wife, the former wife of Mahlon, to be my wife, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance. It's almost as if he's saying, I'm doing this for her. I'm doing this for Naomi, so that the name of Elimelech can perpetuate. It's almost a, kind of an honor, or it's an act of loyalty that he's performing here. It's in order that the dead man's name may stay on his inheritance, in order that the name of the dead may not be cut off from his kindred and from the gate of his native place. Today you are witnesses to this. Then all the people who were at the gate, along with the elders, said, we are witnesses. So this is all the people now responding. We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, like Rachel and Leah, who are the mothers of the 12 tribes, who together built up the house of Israel. May you produce children in Ephrathah, that's the region around Bethlehem, and bestow a name in Bethlehem, and through the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When they came together, the Lord made her conceive. It's interesting, there are two places in this story where we see the direct hand of God at work, where it says, the Lord did this. It's at the beginning, in verse 6, where it says, of chapter 1, where it says, the Lord provided food in Bethlehem. The Lord was the one who provided food. So we have an answer to prayer there. And now, again, we have a God who provides, in that God provides a child. A child to a woman who we can understand as having been barren. I mean, she had no children. She had been married for 10 years. There's no other reason for it. And so the Lord provides. And she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who... Then the women said to Naomi. Now, where did we see women earlier in the story? Women talking.
When they were gathering...
Yeah, they're gathering out in the fields. At the beginning of the story, when they first came into the community, we talked about the gossipers. You know, we talked about the... we'll kind of sneak back here. Some of you hadn't been here at the beginning of the week. Let me see. Chapter 1, verse 19. So they're coming into Bethlehem. Here's Naomi and Ruth, this outsider, coming into Bethlehem. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town stirred because of them. Whenever you see that in the Old Testament, stirred, the whole town stirred, it's gossipers. You know, they were gossiping. What's going, you know, the buzz down at the cafe, at the hairstylist, the gossip was all about this woman coming to town with this outsider. This woman, Naomi, who had lived here, who had grown up here, but now is coming back alone. And she's coming back with this character, Ruth. So we turn back to chapter 4, where we're at. So now these same women, the gossipers here, said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer or a next of kin. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him. It's interesting, we have this kind of contrast from the beginning of the story. The gossipers at the beginning of the story were talking about, they couldn't believe who this woman, what had happened to her back, she'd been gone for 10 years, what's gone on in her life? And now they're celebrating with joy her return to the Bethlehem, and now her return into the community the Lord has provided for her. And then we've got in verse 15, yeah, he shall be to you a restorer of life. This word restorer is another contrast from the beginning of the story. If you turn to chapter 1, verse 21, the same Hebrew word, this word here is the same as the word used in the middle of this verse. I went away full, this is Naomi talking, but the Lord has brought me back empty. That the Hebrew word for brought me back or to bring back is the same word as restorer in this verse 15 that we were just looking at in chapter 4. So I know it's a little bit confusing going back and forth. But he shall be to you as one who brings back your life. There's this whole theme going on in this story about empty and full. At the beginning of the story, Naomi is empty. She's empty. She's been stripped of everything that gives her life and gives her security. And she, you know, she goes on in her little soliloquy here in the first chapter about how, don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me bitter. Call me Mara. Because the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. The Lord has brought me back to this place empty. And now we have this contrast in chapter 4 of a God who has provided abundantly. A God who has brought her back to that former fullness in her homeland. So we read in chapter 4, verse 15, he shall be to you as a restorer of life. It's kind of a testament to the journey that Naomi has been on, from a full family at the beginning to emptiness and now again to restoration, that even through the valleys of life, that there is a God who stays true to God's promises. So he shall be to you as a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him. Seven was a number for perfection in the Old Testament times. And so in saying here, it's even better than perfection that this has happened. And just keeping on here, chapter 4, verse 16. Then Naomi took the child. So the mother took the child, or the grandmother took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. This isn't, it's so much clearer in the Hebrew, but it isn't necessarily that she physically nursed him. Because we know that probably wouldn't have been possible.
A true miracle.
Yes, exactly. One hungry child. But so many people have used this and said, well, what happened here? You know, did she adopt him? Or it just messes up the whole story, you know? And some people get hung up on that. But it would have been impossible. That's not what happened.
She was just glad to have a grandson.
Yes. Yes, she was happy to have a grandson. You know, you picture just this beautiful little child in her arms and her clinging, you know, as Ruth had clung to Naomi, and then as Ruth was instructed to cling to those that would care for her in the field, now we have Naomi clinging to this little child, holding this child, this child that means security for their family, because now the name of Elimelech would continue, and now their land would stay in their family, and again, they are part of the community. They're restored. This child is a symbol and a sign of all this restoration that's happened.
I think verse 17 was really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
The women of the neighborhood named the boy.
Yeah, do you want to, Irene, would you read that verse there?
The women of the neighborhood named the boy Obed.
Yeah.
They told everyone, a son has been born to Naomi. Yeah. A son has been born to Naomi.
Interesting. What do you think of that? I mean, I think there's two things that are curious. Why did the women name the child? And why would they say that she had a son? Any thoughts about that?
Is there any meaning to the name of Obed?
What was it again? Well, my mind immediately went to obedience, you know? I think that's kind of interesting in something like this. Obedience meaning hearing, listening. But I think Obed, if I'm correct, Obed means worshiper, one who worships.
And I think they call it Naomi's son because now the family line will go on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think there's something to that. That now, Naomi having been the one without any, you know, male figure in her life to bring that security that she so sought. Now this is the son. This is the child. Yeah. Go ahead, Irene.
Well, I was just going to say, it's not literally her son, but because she didn't have any, it now became her son. Is that
figurative language? Is that what you're? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. She had lost her son. She had gone away having had two sons. You know, and you think about this small community that would have been her community of support before she left, and now again as she's returning. She had gone away full with a husband and two sons and that had been lost. And now she comes back and those sons that would have been a woman's entire life raising these children, now she's redeemed or restored with these children, these sons.
The faithfulness of God here reminds me of Job.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
God saw him through that whole thing, and Job was never disobedient.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
They came back and blessed him many times more than he had been blessed in the past.
Well, there's a lot of parallels with Job. I mean, you think of her doubting and her, you know, turning on God in the middle of the story. You know, it was God's fault. God's the one who did all this.
Somebody must be to blame.
Yeah, exactly. What do you make of the women of the community naming the child? What do you make of that? Any thoughts about that? I mean, it would have been normal for the father to name the child, but now it's the women of the community.
Maybe it just adds a significance to the to who this child is and his importance and role that he will have in the life of the whole community.
Yeah, that's kind of where as we sit here, that's where my mind went. You know, this. I think this fourth chapter is all about a redemption that goes beyond simply Ruth and Naomi, but it's their inclusion in the life of the community. And so this naming by the community shows this wholeness of the wholeness in the restoration, that they're now a full part of the community and named by the community, that this is one who stands as a full member of the community, no longer an outsider.
Who wrote the Book of Ruth?
Who wrote the Book of Ruth? I don't know this. We don't know who exactly.
And if you go on, I took liberty of going a little farther. Was the father of Jesse, and then the father of David. It is this. To fill in the blank spot of the lineage to David.
Yeah. Many people say that, argue that that was the purpose of this book. There's kind of two arguments to this book, that it was written to kind of, like you said, to fill in the gaps. Okay, how do we get from here to there? You know, how do we connect David throughout the generations here? The other argument is. That it's a book that contrasts what was going on in the Judges, the book of Judges, the book before. Some of you have already done this, but if we go back to the last verse of Judges, we get a sense of what was going on in the time of the Judges. just the very last verse there, it says, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and all the people did what was right in their own eyes." The period of the judges was a violent time. It was a ruthless time. And literally, people did as they saw was right in the eyes of God. It included rape, it included murder and abduction. It was a horrible time. And now we've got, contrasting that, this beautiful story of Ruth, where an outsider is included, where an outsider is brought in, and we have this gracious love of God that's given throughout this story. It's a story of loyalty, and a story of how God uses this outsider to do wonderful things. It's about Boaz, who is this example of faith. And so there's two arguments about that out there. Is it all about, you know, the lineage of David? Is it a way to kind of fill in the gaps? Or is this a story to contrast what was going on in the time of the judges? All right. So, go ahead.
Or what God's overall plan was, he made these situations happen to make a flow down to David.
Yeah. I would argue that this story really is all about the work of a hidden God, of a God working behind the scenes, fulfilling God's promises. And I think so often people want to key in on, okay, who's the main character of the story? So is it about, you know, Ruth and Naomi, or is it about Boaz? But I think really the main character of the story is God at work in the lives of God's people, doing miracles. So we go on, and just the last section here is this genealogy of David. Now, there are descendants of Perez. Perez became the father of Hezron, Hezron of Ram, Ram of Amminadab, Amminadab, and Nashon, Nashon of Solomon, Solomon of Boaz, Boaz of Obed, Obed of Jesse, and Jesse of David. And so we have this connection to David, that even in David's family, God uses outsiders, people from this foreign land who would have been excluded, who would have, under the law, even within marriage, would have been kicked out of the land of Israel. And so God using outsiders to perpetuate the line of David. If we turn, let's go to the New Testament now, just to kind of wrap up our time together today. In the book of Matthew, as Christian people, we see this bloodline continuing in the book of Matthew. We have the, right away, Matthew chapter 1, we've got another genealogy. And whenever I read the Bible, I usually skip over genealogies, you know. It's like, okay, all these names I can't pronounce and whatnot. But I think this one's very fascinating. This is interesting. An account of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah, and his brothers, Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, by Tamar. Tamar, if you remember to the Old Testament, is a woman who had kind of her own bag of issues, you could say. This is an unlikely female to be included. And Perez, the father of Hezron, and Hezron, the father of Aram, and Aram, the father of never pronounce that one correctly. Anyone want to try that?
Amminadab.
There you are. Amminadab. And Amminadab, the father of Nashon, and Nashon, the father of Solomon, and Solomon, the father of Boaz by Rahab. We have another interesting character. And Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth. And Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. So we've got right there several characters that these characters with kind of strange pasts. You've got Tamar, you've got Rahab, and you've got Ruth, all included in what will be the lineage of Jesus. And we have in Matthew, go ahead, Irene.
I was just going to say something that's been in my mind ever since we started this Bible study, and I had mentioned it yesterday or so. Maybe this is the answer to my question of why did Ruth go to her mother-in-law and not take care of her own parents? Seemed to be an abandonment of her own family to now be a part of the lineage to through David and Jesus.
Yeah, it is. I think that whole...
Do you have any insight on that?
Well, all we have is what is in Scripture. You know, we have this story of Ruth, and it doesn't really say why Ruth turned and went, you know, and followed Naomi. We can only assume that it's out of this loyalty, you know?
Part of God's plan.
Well, and sometimes I think that we, rather than using the language of plan, rather thinking of God at work in Ruth's life, that, you know, sometimes people will use the language of God's plan kind of abusively, I think, and I think we have to be careful about it, because we know that God has desires for us. You know, God desires fruitfulness. But maybe that God somehow was at work in Ruth's life, and knowing that this outsider is now going, has the potential to become part of this beautiful lineage through David, you know, through Abraham to David, and now on to Jesus, who we hold in faith, in the Christian faith. I think definitely God's hand at work in Ruth's life. I think that's a wonderful way to look at it. Why would Ruth turn on her family? There would have been plenty of Moabite boys back there in Moab for her to hook up with, you know. But no, she doesn't. She chooses this alternative path, you know. She chooses something different. And I think we can attribute that. Now looking back from our point of view of, you know, from the Christian point of view, going, okay, yeah, Ruth did play an important role in the life of David and now Jesus.
May I make a comment here? Is that the only four women mentioned in the genealogy are Rahab, Ruth, Tamar, and then Mary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. That's kind of interesting. Why those?
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. And there is this, one of the commentaries I read, there is, because of the strange circumstance of Ruth's marriage, and then what we know about the story of Tamar, how the child came to be. One of the commentaries that I read said that it was preparing us for an even stranger conception that Mary would have. You know, the sometimes you find these quotes, you know, that little children say, and one of them was, Jesus was born because Mary had an immaculate contraption. But I think this speaks to, you know, that Jesus would be born under unusual circumstances. But also that Jesus would be one whose mission would include the outcast. That Jesus' mission would include these women. That Jesus' mission includes all people, regardless of sex, race. This would be a God whose love is greater than any bounds we can put on it.
There's kind of a term for this kind of like a flowering promise that as time moves on, it flowers more and more, you know, in the Scriptures. Second-class citizens are really a part of the whole kingdom.
There's this message of justice, you know, and I think the book of Ruth is pretty remarkable if you think about it in the midst of the patriarchal society. You know, this all these books about, you know, wars and about judges and about kings and rulers, and then you have this story of these two lowly women you know, that are placed smack dab in the middle of the genealogy of David and then Jesus. I mean, it's a remarkable, you know, when we think about inclusive language today and issues of inclusivity in terms of sexuality, this back in ancient times would have been just the same. It's saying, people, wake up! God's love is bigger than the types of boxes you try and put on God's kingdom.
That's really something for Matthew to, you know, was writing this very Jewish book.
Yeah.
To have these little insights.
Yeah, because
I wonder how aware he was of what he was writing.
Yeah, because Matthew is writing fearful of letting go of the past. You know, he's writing to he's a Jewish person, writing to a Jewish audience out of all this fear of letting go of all the rules and the laws and whatnot. And yeah, how knowledgeable. That's a good question. Any other thoughts on Ruth as we kind of are wrapping up the book here? Ruth is just, for me, it is this beautiful book of a faithful God, a God who's faithful to Naomi. I mean, the story is about Naomi, but it takes all these twists and turns. It's a story about how God uses people from the lowly Ruth, the outsider, the one who shouldn't have been accepted by anyone, to the wealthy, prominent Boaz. God uses all of God's people from beginning to end to liberate Naomi, to bring her back into the fold, into the community, and to restore life. That God is this one present throughout the journey.
Now, I have a problem. My problem is that in the genealogy of Matthew, Rahab is the mother of Boaz.
Oh, yeah.
Unless I misread that. It says Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, didn't it?
I think it did.
And that's not the case in the book of Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all those genealogies in the Gospels are kind of, you know, they're not really trying to be linear. They're trying to say something. You know, they're trying to say, and so Jesus was like this, and Jesus was like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you go to the other Gospels, where's there another big genealogy? Is it in
Luke?
I think Luke has one too. You'll notice that it's totally, you know, there are some similarities, but there are differences as well. And so what, you know, again, it goes back to, like you said, what is the author trying to get across here, you know? For me, you know, in Matthew, he's trying to sneak in these prominent women, you know, these unlikely characters to be within the genealogy of Jesus. Good, good. Well, thank you for journeying through Ruth here this week. This has been nice.
Thank you.
It's been very good.
Thank you very much, Lee.
How long? You guys are leaving tomorrow, is that right?
No, Sunday.
You're just leaving Sunday. You'll be around. John, you're leaving
tomorrow. You're leaving tomorrow too?
Yeah. Yeah.
They've
had enough of us.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, we'll have class tomorrow. We're gonna do something a little different.
Oh.
Tomorrow.
Get advanced tomorrow.
No. At least you are. Practice up on that.
I need to bring my dancing shoes.
You wouldn't care to share what we're going to do tomorrow.
What are we going to do tomorrow?
Is that a secret?
It's kind of a secret because I'm not exactly sure yet.
Sorry.
That's
a
I know it's a secret. I think what I'd really like to do is look at some of the New Testament stories that includes, like, the woman at the well, some of these stories of faithful women in the New Testament. That's kind of what I'd like to do, but do it in a little different format, maybe more discussion oriented rather than me blabbing the whole time. That sound? Would you be interested in that? Okay. That'd be good. All right, thank you, everybody. Have a good day. Yeah.
Oh, that's my wife's luggage. Like, yeah, right. All right.
Different jeans for sure.
Yeah.
Hey. How are you?
Hi.
Get your colors picked out?
Mm-hmm.
Good?
You're still looking. He's still looking up lineages.
You're looking up lineages?
Good.
I wasn't here. Is that correct that Boaz?
We don't have anything. Take it.
We don't have anything of Boaz's lineage. I'm trying to think of where you could go to look for that. Oh, if you go to the story of Tamar in Genesis 38.
Oh,
I think it has some of that. But yeah.
But it doesn't always neatly fit together, does it?
No.
That's why it keeps us on our toes.
Yeah.
It was oral tradition.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know, that's part of it. You know, it depends on, you know, the human element. It depends on what resources they have there. What traditions they have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And how?
I'm just going to bring you your coat.
Well, right. Thank you. It was very interesting.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for coming.
Let's go get some coffee.
I know.